Good evening. Welcome to Westminster Abbey. My name is David Hoyle. I'm the Dean. And welcome to a really important occasion for us. The Abbey, I probably don't need to tell you this, is a place of national memorial. So behind you is the grave of the unknown warrior. The Abbey is a theatre of nation and monarchy. Also to the west of you is the coronation chair. This is a place of pilgrimage. Behind me is the shrine of Edward the Confessor. And this is also a major tourist attraction. But above all, the Abbey is a church where we proclaim the gospel. And right at the heart of the gospel is our hope. We meet tonight one of the great theological voices of a generation. Another voice from that generation, Henry Chadwick, once began a sermon that I heard by saying, "If you ask me, as a historian and as a theologian, what gift the church has made to the world, that gift would be hope." Tonight we gather for the Gore lecture. Charles Gore, a rather colourful character and canon of Westminster, took that hope seriously. So tonight, in wonderful company, yours and Professor Maltman's, we gather to celebrate our fundamental identity as a community of hope. And now to introduce our speaker, another colourful canon of Westminster, my colleague Canon Hawkey.
Ladies and gentlemen, as the Dean said, Charles Gore was a canon here between 1894 and 1902. As a memorial to Gore, an endowment fund for a series of annual lectures was established, and since 1935, a lecture has been given here in his honour almost every year. It is an enormous honour to welcome Professor Jürgen Moltmann to give tonight's lecture. Professor Moltmann's Theology of Hope of 1964, the first of a trilogy, shaped a generation of theological thinkers and continues to stand as a highly influential text today. Professor Emeritus of Systematic Theology at the University of Tübingen, he is one of the most distinguished theologians of the second half of the 20th century, and his work has been as much for the church as for the academy. In his edited collection of essays, Lux Mundi, first published in 1889, Charles Gore's contribution on the Holy Spirit and inspiration, in which he offers a positive assessment of contemporary scientific discovery and a critical theological method, concludes with a quotation from the letter to the Romans. "Whatsoever things were written aforetime were written for our learning, that we through patience and comfort of the scriptures might have hope." Professor Moltmann, Charles Gore would, I think, be delighted that you are here to give this evening's lecture, exploring a theology of hope for the 21st century, taking inspiration from a line of Friedrich Hölderlin, "But where there is danger, salvation also grows," as you offer us your thoughts on a culture of life in the dangers of this time. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Professor Jürgen Moltmann.
Thank you for the generous invitation to speak on this famous Westminster Abbey. It is a great honor to give the Charles Gore Lecture. My first encounter with Britain happened exactly 75 years ago, in February of 1945, a British-Canadian operation through the Reichswald near Kleve began. My unit was scattered. I lost my way at night and found myself alone in the woods until I met a group of British soldiers. I called, I surrender, and they didn't shoot me, but rather talked with me. The next morning, a compassionate lieutenant gave a plate of baked beans to the hungry prisoner. I have loved baked beans ever since. For me, the taste of life. With this adventure, my long journey to theology began in the United Kingdom. I am always grateful to have met God in Christ in the prisoner of war camps in Scotland, in England. In this lecture, I would like to speak about an issue that has been staring people the most for quite some time. A culture of life stronger than the barbarism of killings. A love for life that defies the imminent destruction of the world we live in. And a confidence in the future that overcomes our apathy. I would like to start with a verse by the German poet Friedrich Hölderlin and follow his gaze into the universal future of the world. Wo aber Gefahr ist, wächst das Rettende auch. But where there is danger, salvation also grows. We will have to see whether this hope means comfort or illusion to us as we inquire into the possibilities of a culture of life in the face of the tangible destructions menacing us and our world. I will set out with a look at the dangers and offer in response dimensions of a world capable of supporting life and in a literal sense worthy of our love. And in the end, I would like to return to the first verse of Friedrich Hölderlin's celebrated poem Patmos. Nah ist und schwer zu fassen der Gott. Near and hard to grasp is the God. Part 1, the terror of death. I start with the poison of hatred. Human life itself is in danger today. Humanity of life is threatened. Life is not in danger because it is menaced by death, for it always has been. It is in danger because it no longer respected and affirmed. It is no longer loved. After the Second World War, Albert Camus stated, "The secret of Europe is that it no longer loves life." Anyone who took part in the World War II knows what he meant. After 70 years of peace in Europe, we are facing a humanity of enmity today. In the 20th century, it is a state operating terror from above in forms of fascism and Stalinism. Today we are experiencing the private terror from below. Your young people love life, Mullah Omar of the Taliban told Western journalists. Our young people love death. Suicide assassins love death of their enemies on their own death. That is the terror of the Islamic State in Iraq and of Boko Haram in Africa towards the godless Western world that they feel threatened by. The victim mentality always leads to anger and to hate. These days, this terror has been joined ranks by white terror on Norway, New Zealand, and Texas, and Germany have witnessed. The terror of white supremacy, of white racism. In many Western nations, a climate of hate has been fostered, promoting such hate against those perceived as outsiders, against migrants, Jews, and disliked politicians. Our public atmosphere has been poisoned ever since we have had anonymous Twitter and on the internet, hate via World Wide Web. Question is, how can human civilization prevail against these odds? Point number two, nationalism. The political problem we are facing is new nationalism. The big nations of the world are at war in the middle of peace. It is a hybrid war of economic sanctions and cyber wars with fake news. In the struggle for power, the new nationalists seem to believe in the survival of the fittest, because they deem their own nation to be the fittest. Neo-nationalism began at the end of the East-West conflict in 1990. Up until then, the world has been divided into two blocks, the socialist world in the East and the free world in the West. Then the Soviet Union dissolved itself. Gorbachev lost and Yeltsin won in 1993. The Soviet Union disintegrated into larger and smaller nations. The socialist dream of equality of all people died. The free world dissolved more slowly. The alliance of democratic states disintegrated until President Trump asserted the U.S. nationalism, America first. The USA felt overburdened to be the protecting power of the free world. The USA is rescinding multilateral treaties of the United Nations. The Paris Climate Protection Agreement of 2015, the INF Treaty of 1987, banning nuclear short-range missiles in Europe, the agreement with Iran, and so forth. Neo-nationalism is also stirring in the nations of the European Union, coming from the right wing. In so-called ethnically pure nations, the members of one's own clan or tribe are considered fellow human beings. Everyone else is a foreigner or outsider. A line is drawn between us and the others. The friend foe category is the existential category of neo-nationalism. Just as Lilith, professor for constitutional law, Carl Schmitt, has taught. Question: does this mean the democratic dream for humanity had died as well? number three, the nuclear suicide problem. This new focus on one's own nation poses a threat to the survival of humankind, considering that atomic bombs are still in the hands of individual nations. When the atomic bombs were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki in August 1945, not only did the Second World War end, but the entire human race entered its end times as well. I do not mean that in an apocalyptic sense at all. End times is the age when the end of the human race is possible any moment. No one could survive the nuclear winter after a large-scale nuclear war. It is true that since the end of the Cold War in 1990, the great atomic war has been not been very legal. But in the USA, Russia, China, England, and France, in India, and Pakistan, Israel, and North Korea, there are still vast arsenals of atomic and hydrogen bombs awaiting the self-destruction of humankind, following the rationale whoever fires first dies second. This is your morally assured destruction that paradoxically has been assured the world peace that since 1945. It is a latent but ever present suicide program of the nations as the Russian nuclear scientist Sakharov put it, which many have forgotten because it has been repressed from public awareness. Years ago in Prague, President Obama reminded us of the ideal of a world without nuclear weapons. But President Putin bolded the Russians' new weapons in 2018, and President Trump rescinded the INF treaty banning nuclear short-range missiles in Europe, which Reagan and Gorbachev has gauchely edited. This means in you face of nuclear armament has begun, a new feature of which are the missiles, boosters that you reduce warning times to a minimum. The great atomic war looms over humankind like a sinister fate. And we feel its effect on public awareness in what American psychologists call nuclear numbing. We repress our anxiety, try to forget this threat, and yet it is gnawing on it under subconscious and impairing our love for life. Question: will the nations reach an agreement on a world without nuclear weapons, or will the nations continue to menace each other with the nuclear murder of humankind? The last danger I'm speaking about is the ecological catastrophe of our world. In contrast to the nuclear threat to humanity, the ecological catastrophe is discussed under the harmless word climate change is no longer merely a threat already an incipient catastrophe in several parts of the earth. Fire in Australia and droughts in South Africa. It is not only a latent problem. But a very prominent one in public awareness. Greta Thunberg's wake-up call Friday for Future has been heard worldwide. At the United Nations Climate Change Conference in Paris in 2015, the nations paid attention for the first time to the cry of the suffering earth. People can see the climate change, feel its heat, and then its polluted air. The ecological catastrophe has come to pass exactly as the Club of Rome predicted in its report the limits to growth in 1972. We know all of this, and yet we are paralyzed because we continue to believe in growth produces more, consuming more in a type of superstitious worship as if growth would bring more joy to our life. It has been said that it is too late for pessimism. Climate change is the extinction of species, signals for a major change facing our scientific, technological civilization should we wish to survive. It concerns our common world view and our personal way of life. Question: will we find time and energy enough to change our lifestyle and our economy so that our children can live? We don't know whether humankind will survive its self-induced destiny and be able to liberate itself from these suicide types. And that is a good thing. If we knew that we had no chance of surviving, we would do nothing about our predicament. If we knew that we were definitely going to survive, we wouldn't do anything either. Only if the future is open to both possibilities, are we compelled to do today what is necessary to avert the pending calamity? Because we do not know whether humanity will survive, we must act today as if the future of humankind depended on us, and yet trust that we and our children will survive. Question here: but need the human race to survive at all? One might ask cynically, didn't the dinosaurs also come and go? That is the end, the existential question. Is humankind to be or not to be? As Hamlet business of humankind. There are more than 7 billion human beings living on Earth today. The Earth could just as well be uninhabited. It existed without humans for the longest period of time and very likely continue to exist for millions of years should the human race succumb to its demise. Where are we here merely by chance, or is it inherent to the blueprint of evolution that we humans were to appear? If nature had a strong anthropic principle, then we could feel at home in the universe. As the book title by Stuart Kaufman promises. But such strong anthropic principle is, however, perhaps not verifiable. If we search the cosmos for an answer of existential question, we will arrive at Steve Weinberg's observation. The more the universe seems comprehensible, the more it also seems pointless. The silence of the space and the coldness of the universe are already terrified place by God. Neither the stars in the sky nor the genes in our bodies tell us whether mankind should exist on Earth or not. But how can we love life and affirm our existence if in the end it is an accident of nature, basically superfluous and without relevance for the cause of the world? Is there a duty to exist, or a duty to ensure a future, as Hans Jonas inquired? We should find no answer than every culture of life will remain uncertain and subject to barbarism. Is this I take that to? A culture of life is a culture of common life of humankind and the Earth. Are unseres Rats Geräte sehen Sie Powers of Salvation, Human Rights and Humanity, the nationalism of the past led us to the madness of two world wars in the 20th century. Yet at the beginning of American and European modern era, humanism was born. Human rights and the ethos of humanity. Christian Brotherhood was extended to general human brotherhood, fraternity, and Philadelphia. Everyone who knows the Ode to Joy of Friedrich Schiller put to music in Beethoven's 9th symphony. Joy, the beauteous, godly lightning, thy enchantments bind together. What disconcern, stern divide, every man becomes a brother where thy gently winds abide. The first article of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights also praises the spirit of brotherhood. The American Declaration of Independence codified human rights, affirming the belief that all men are created equal and free. The French Revolution spread these rights in Europe: liberty, equality, fraternity. Immanuel Kant considered the commonwealth of humankind based on human rights to be not only the ultimate objective of human history, but also the final end of creation. Thus spanning the human and the natural world. And Kant anticipated such a commonwealth of humankind to bring about eternal peace. After the cooling Second World War, with its 55 million of dead people, the United Nations were founded in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, proclaimed in 1948. The International Covenant on Economic and Social and Cultural Rights followed in 1966, and the Convention on the rights of the child in 1989. Modern democracies are based on human rights and anticipations of a politically organized world community, the commonwealth of humankind. Democracy is based on the sovereignty of the people. All power emanates from the people, which means from the citizens, not from the people of one race or one tribe or one class or one gender. Democracies are based on human rights. Human dignity is inviolable. Because democracies were not human rights democracies. Domestically, democracies are concerned with human rights, not with ethnic or class rights. Gottfried Ephraim Lessing illustrated the meaning of humanity in his famous drama, Nathan Sobers. Are Jews and Christians races such than men? Oh, if I knew I could have found another yet for whom it was enough to be a human being. One might feel tempted to apply this to today's national conflicts. Are Germans and migrants rather such than human beings? Are Americans and Hispanics, are Croats and Serbs, are Europeans and Africans, or, and if I found in thee one more to whom is this enough to be a human being. Humanity means brotherhood and sisterhood and means solidarity, taking part in other lives and sharing part in one's own life. Terrorism emerges in the hearts and heads of the people and must be overcome in the hearts and heads of the people. Only the language of life is successful. But we are told the terrorists understand only the language of violence. But our language of violence raised the number of terrorists in the world from a few hundred in the time of Bin Laden to 10,000 today in our time. We want them not being killed, but we want them to convert from death to life. Living with a bomb. The dream of a world was to look weapons is only a dream. Nobody is expecting humans to someday cease being able to do what they can do today. And yet, the nuclear age is also the first common age of all nations. Since Hiroshima, the separate histories of the nations have become intertwined in a common world history of humankind, because all may fall victim. In this situation, survival is only conceivable if nations unite as a collective agent for peace. Only the international community of nations can organize partnership for security and thus pave the way for a transnational federation of humanity. This life-saving union of humankind in an age of nuclear threat requires that the individual interest of the nations be restricted to humankind's common interest in survival. We must finally get started with nuclear disarmament. Nuclear bombs are no military but purely political weapons, and the political security of nations can just as well be guaranteed by means of peace treaties. United Nations can ostracize nuclear weapons just as chemical warfare and land mines were ostracized. Planetary solidarity. If nature's dying leads to a crisis within a life system that connects human society with their own surrounding nature. This is logically implies a crisis of the entire system. The current ecological crisis is such a total crisis. It can so far not been solved. Technology alone, but demands a change of our outlook of life as well, of our way of life and way of eating, of our society's basic values. Which basic values rule over our modern scientific technological civilization? It is predominantly the will to power over the nature of the earth. Knowledge is power, St. Francis Bacon. Modern industrial societies are no longer oriented towards harmony with the cycles and rhythms of the earth as agrarian societies were, but rather toward growth and progress and globalization according to humanity's own project. And you, anthropocentrism, supplanted the old cosmos orientation. There is a well-known old ecological joke. Two planets meet in space. One asks, "How are you doing?" The other answers, "I'm not well at all. I'm quite ill. I've got Homo sapiens." The first replies, "I'm sorry for you. That is rough. I had them too once. But don't worry, it will pass." That is the neo-planetary perspective on humankind. Will the human planetary disease pass as human race does away with itself, or will it pass because the human race grows wise and heals the wounds it has been inflicted in the planet Earth up until this very day? We cannot return to pre-modern cosmos orientation, but we can commence the ecological transformation of oil and industry. It is the question of the sustainability integrating the human society in the living conditions of the earth. The linear concept of growth and progress in production, consumption, and more waste and garbage. Can be replaced by cycles. Only cyclical approaches won't decay. The cycles of renewable energies and recycling economy nearly us what became of your last Andy. Your future of human economy is perhaps to be found in human garbage, not in the earth. The Earth Charter of 2000 and to this future. Humanity is part of a fast evolving universe. As all is life with a unique unity of life, the protection of life of Earth, vitality and diversity and human beauty is a sacred trust. I come to the end. Human life implies not only the gift of life, but also the responsibility of being human, embracing and accomplishing this in times of terror requires a great courage to live. Life must be lived privately and publicly. Life must be lived to day in defiance of terror and dangers. The German philosopher Friedrich Hegel, a friend of Hölderlin since the time of studying together in Tübingen, expresses in the following words: not a life that shrinks from death and remains untouched by devastation, but a life that endures death and maintains itself in it is the life of the spirit. näher es hat, du gasp es Gott. Question: should humankind exist are we superfluous? Do we have a duty to exist? These existential questions of human existence are not answered by means of rational arguments, but foremost by pre-rational orientation, by people's basic trust or mistrust in life. It is not the distant God that is hard to grasp, but rather God's being near to us. God is closer to us than we are to ourselves. That is where we cannot grasp God. He is too near, and we are ever in turn grasped and inspired by God. We not know the answer to the existential questions of humanity. And God's eternal yes to creation, we affirm our existence in spite of dangers and deaths. In God's eternal yes to creation, we affirm our existence in spite of death. In God's eternal love, we love this life and resist its destructions. With God near, we trust in salvation, even if danger grows. Near and hard to grasp is the God where there is danger, salvation also grows. Thank you for your attention.
In God's eternal yes, you have given us a call to a new vision of what it is to be a human actor on this planet. We've moved through terrorism and ecology, through a vast array of illustrations of dangers and signs of hope, and I think landed at the fundamental question, to be or not to be for humankind. Professor Maltman, you have never dodged the big questions, and you've not dodged them this evening. We have a few minutes just for one or two questions. We'd like to kick us off. Professor Quash, there's a microphone coming round, I think. In in the second row just here at the front.
Thank you so much, Professor Moltmann. I wanted to ask about what word you would wish to replace power with in the phrase the will to power. You pointed to the way in which modern industrial societies have been governed by the will to power. And it seems to me that...
I didn't got the question.
I can repeat the question.
Yeah.
So the question is that modern societies are governed by a will to power. What word would you replace for power in your schema instead of will to power? Is that right?
Yeah. Solidarity. Taking part in other life, giving part in one's own life.
Solidarity has been right at the heart of everything you've said this evening about the human family and our relationship with the wider earth. Possibly time for one more question. Thank you, Ben. I will briefly abuse the responsibility of the chair and ask whether you think there is ever a good kind of nationalism. Can there be a good kind of nationalism in the modern world?
Yeah. I admire the nationalism of Britain. Britain seems to me to be a national innocence. Why Germany lost the national innocence in the Nazi dictatorship. And therefore nationalism in your country is different than in my country. The spirits of the past coming up again in Germany.
That's a very great warning to us all.
Mr. Moltmann, thank you for a clear-sighted and penetrating account of the dangers and challenges we face. Thank you for a summons to courage, and thank you too for a reminder that we are called also to live fully as human beings. Tonight has been an extraordinary and memorable evening. Amidst all of that, I will also take away with me that gripping sense of the nearness of God, for which I am deeply grateful. I can't remember the entire poem. R.S. Thomas has an extraordinary poem about a violinist on a stage. Thomas arrives, I think, rather late and finds himself sitting on the stage near this violinist and watches in a kind of horror as the violinist plays, because there's a kind of agony going on as the violinist plays. The poem ends with Thomas saying, "And closer than them all, the God listened." Tonight, we listened with huge appreciation, and you have reminded us of the closeness of God. Thank you.